This is PCJ Radio International.
Radio Berlin International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch rural broadcasting system in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette McQuarrie and Keith Perrell.
Well, hello friends around the world and welcome to the monthly edition of Media Network Plus. Yes, the monthly edition of Media Network Plus is very different from the weekly 30-minute edition in that we compile the best reports from the weekly show and put them together on this one-hour version. There is a reason for that, because there are some shows that only run the one-hour version, so we bring them the best of the program. Now, first up on today's show, because we have a lot of things to get to, Canada's mobile phone market is not exactly the most competitive in the world. The government wants to open it up to make it more competitive by allowing more companies in. But this is causing a bit of friction between the mobile phone companies and the government. To find out more, we're now joined on the line by our own Paulette McQuarrie in Vancouver, Canada.
Well, yeah, you really hit the nail on the head, if there is any. It's tricky. We don't have a large population relative to the geography that we live on. So competition is a problem. We've got some incumbents. You mentioned big three, TELUS, Bell, and Rogers. They have a hard enough time duking it out, but there's a bit of collusion going on, too, because we have some of the highest telecom rates in the world. We've got just ridiculous roaming charges, but it is hard for little guys to come in.
So let me ask you, you talked about, say, high charges and high roaming charges, but there are these big three. But is it just is it just the thing that these are three big, well-established companies and they don't want to step on each other's toes and they just kind of want to keep the status quo?
Well, it seems to be a lot of that, Keith, quite frankly. And they, you know, like to lobby government and they like to protect their turf. And you've got upstarts that have been coming in, and the government, the current government, since they've been a majority, have tried to support smaller upstarts. For example, Wind. We spoke about Wind on a program about a year or so ago, maybe two now, and it was owned by an Egyptian media mogul, and he came in with great plans, great hopes for providing some really good service and some stiff competition. Unfortunately, it just didn't work out that way, and I think one of the big problems is that there were rules and regulations put in place, but they really weren't enforced. So you things like tower sharing, things about like roaming rates, they just kind of went by the wayside. The incumbents were allowed to come in and actually, ironically, undercut the little guys. So they've been doing things that really weren't intended to support them, but to support the newcomers. So I think that there is, like you said, it's when you started out, Keith, is a competition is for some a dirty word, and the government has to really play politics a lot. They've got to balance, the pro and the anti-competition types, because really they can't do anything unless they're elected, and to get elected they have to please everybody, you know. So it is hard to do business in Canada, I think. think largely because of politics, but also just simply, the question is, do we have the population base to support a competitive market and a lot of competitors in this field? Because it is an expensive industry to start up and to maintain, much like airlines, for example.
Well, let me tell you something interesting. You know, we've seen a lot of news lately about Burma finally opening up to the world. Now, the communications sector in Burma, which is years behind even underdeveloped nations, has just started allowing foreign competition to come into Burma to increase competition from the local provider. Now, in Burma, Paulette, right now, if you want a SIM card for your mobile phone, the cost is $800. That's just for the SIM card.
Wow.
And it's not like you can apply and get it. You have to go through a lottery. Now, they've just let in two foreign communication companies, one from Norway and another one from Australia, that have come in and have offered SIM cards for less than $15, which has shaken up the main government-run communications provider. So what I'm sort of seeing is that countries, let's say, that are developing their communication system want foreign owners to come in to make more competition for the domestic market. But it seems that in Canada, it's the other way around.
Well, in Canada, the public opinion appears to be split, from what I can tell from some of the comments to articles on this issue. There is a certain element that is completely opposed to foreign ownership, and this is kind of like a protectionist mentality where, we have to have our own, and we can't have people from outside the country coming in and buying up our industries, and we lose our identity and our culture and that kind of stuff. And then there is the other side of people who do understand that, that's a little bit of an extremist fear, and it's just pragmatic and practical to have people come in from outside the company who, A, probably have more experience because they've been operating on a global in a global marketplace, and are just better heeled than Canadians, and can actually give provide some competition and maybe shake things up. But you get the impression sometimes here in Canada that nobody wants to be shaken up. We're very comfortable, thank you very much. But we don't realize that we're on a downhill slide. We are not competitive with the world.
Let me ask you a question on this then, because running a communications network, mobile or whatever, actually it's not a cheap thing to do. It costs a lot of money. The question is, does anybody in Canada have the money to come along and to create a new network when you have, let's say, networks from overseas that are willing to come in, willing to invest in infrastructure, more modern infrastructure that is currently being invested in? Is this not a concern? We have to bring the foreign money in because Canadians are not willing to put money into it.
Well, that is a consideration, absolutely. And as we saw with wind, that was, the government did go there. They did open that up, and they were able to because they were finally a majority government for many years prior to that, when the Harper government was in a minority position. It would have been completely a death knell. They would have just sealed their own coffin by attempting to open things up to foreign ownership. I mean, the opposition would have just pounced on them. They would have been kicked out of office, and they would not have had a chance to be elected. So they had to go slow, and they did go slow. They eventually they did become a majority government. Then they did allow wind to come in with foreign ownership, and they were in a majority position, so they could do that. And as I mentioned earlier, what they did not do was really see that the rules, the new rules and regulations allowing competition for the benefit of the Canadian consumer, I might add, that those rules and regulations were actually enforced, and they weren't. So as I said before, that the incumbents then could come in and undercut those upstarts, cut them off the knees before they got established and were able to really provide any serious competition. So that's the situation in Canada right now. I think that the government wants to address that. They want to level the playing field. But they, again, they have to play politics because a lot of these big companies support them to get elected. So they do have to, you know, try to keep a balance, keep everybody happy. That being said, Michael Geist, one of the gurus in Canada on the whole communications industry, did note that the big three telecoms were taken by surprise. They did not expect the government to come out with these kinds of decisions. They blocked a merger recently between Mobilicity and TELUS, wanted to take over Mobilicity. Mobilicity is an upstart that has been struggling, and they wanted to take over their spectrum. They fully expected that they would be able to. The government said no. So they're reeling a little bit. Maybe the scenario that you laid out, Keith, by companies like Far East Tone to shake things up, to come in, provide serious competition, actually show some of these more entrenched, maybe stodgy companies, comes to becoming stodgy, on how to do business in a new way. I mean, you know, things are changing. This is such a rapidly changing industry, and you cannot sit rest on your laurels. And yes, you've had an infrastructure. Yes, you had, you know, you were able to dominate this market. So now you can rest easy. There's no such thing. And that's what competition is all about. That's what big companies don't like. But that's what consumers do like. And this government has to, if they want to get reelected, they have to please the consumers. And that's what they're trying to do.
So let me ask you, I mean, if I headed to, say, Montreal, Toronto, or Vancouver, walked down the street and went up to somebody and said, look, what do you think of mobile phone service in Canada? What do you think about how much you're paying? What do you think about the services that are being offered? What do you think most people in Canada would say?
Well, those that know anything about the industry would say, we pay too much. Plain and simple, we pay too much. And we don't get as good service as we deserve. That's what I think. I could be wrong because I'm certainly not an expert on the industry, but just based from, you know, my own personal experience, it's ridiculous. For basic service, which is I'd have no roaming. I have a smartphone, but I don't have a plan that uses it. I'm paying $25 essentially to have a mobile phone for emergencies. And if I'm in a Wi-Fi area, like at home or in a hot Wi-Fi hotspot, I can't access the internet. But that's it. Roaming charges, forget it. I shut my cell phone off when I go south of the border. I pay $25 a month for that, plus tax, of course.
So, for example, if you were to use your phone across the border in the United States, which is not too far away, how much more would you be expected to pay if you wanted, say, data services or make phone calls?
I'd probably double it. I mean, and I have done when I first got it, and I did make a few calls, to my husband across town or whatever, and it doubled. And it was not, I spent a lot of time on the phone either. Texting is free. Texting is okay. But, so that's what I use the phone largely for, is texting, emergency local calls, and maybe accessing the internet if I'm in a Wi-Fi area. And that's it. But yeah, if I would try to use that and make really good use of it as a communications tool south of the border, I would at least double it. I'm quite sure.
Well, I'm sure, Paulette, this is a story that is going to continue for some time. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
You are very welcome.
And I'm sure that's one story we're going to be following this year, as some new rulings from the CRTC will be coming down very shortly. You're listening to the monthly version of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Just recently, the Sri Lanka Broadcasting Corporation shut down the Ekala transmitter site. This station has a long history. It goes back to around the Second World War and was actually one of the world's first commercial shortwave stations. And it had a huge following, especially during the Radio Ceylon days. And people in this region have fond memories, well, that's people of a certain age group, of some of the programs that they were putting out. We're now going to have a little tribute to the Ekala Relay Station in Sri Lanka. It's produced and presented by our good friend, Jeff White.
You have been tuned into the commercial service of the Ceylon Broadcasting Corporation. We were with you on 326 meters, 59.58 meters, and also on rediffusion. The programs of the English National Service can be heard on the frequencies you are tuned to right now at 5 o'clock. And we shall be back again at 6 o'clock this evening on 483.8 meters, 365 meters, 61.6 meters, and also on rediffusion. Till then, this is yours truly, Raj.
The beginning of the story of the SEAC radio station at Akola goes way back to the year 1941, when preliminary work began on the construction of a shortwave station for the home service radio broadcasting station, Radio Colombo. The chosen location for this new transmitter station was some 10 miles north of Colombo City and about 5 miles from the deep waters of the nearby ocean. Then, when Lord Louis Mountbatten came into the picture during the latter part of the war in Asia, work on this new shortwave station was taken over, enlarged, and speeded up. The Akola project, now under the auspices of SEAC, the Southeast Asia Command, became a matter of high priority. A nearby radio communication station, already in operation by the Royal Air Force, became a temporary interim location for the broadcast of programming from the studios of SEAC Radio at 191 Turret Road, Colombo, just opposite the town hall. The first on-air test from the RAF station at Akola took place on October 11, 1944, with the use of a 7.5-kilowatt RCA transmitter model ET4750. The on-air slogan at this stage was United Nations Radio Kandy. The ace international radio monitor in Sri Lanka, the noted Victor Gunatilaka, informs us that the two radio stations, RAF Akola and SEAC Akola, were both established on the same large property, though these days a housing complex lies in between. According to the historians, the first transmitter and an antenna system taken from the Isle of Wight were sent out from England by boat. However, the ship with its cargo was torpedoed and sunk off the coast of Ceylon. A second transmitter and antenna system were sent out from England by ship a few months later, and these arrived safely in Colombo for installation at SEAC Akola. Another RCA transmitter, ET4750, at 7.5 kilowatts, and the Marconi SWB18 at 100 kilowatts were installed simultaneously in the new transmitter hall at SEAC Akola towards the end of the year 1945, and test broadcasts began in early 1946. Both transmitters were taken into service on May 1st, and the official opening ceremony was conducted 1 week later on May 8, 1946. Soon afterwards, a second RCA unit, ET4750, at 7.5 kilowatts was installed, and in addition, a 1-kilowatt RCA shortwave unit was installed, and we would conclude that this was the old original pre-war VPB from Velikada, modified and upgraded to 1 kilowatt. At this stage, 4 transmitters were on the air, 3 for international coverage and 1 for island-wide coverage. International programming was beamed towards India, the North Pacific, Burma, and Japan, and England. With the rapid onward progress of the war in Asia, Mountbatten transferred his SEAC headquarters from Kandy in Colombo in Ceylon to Singapore in Malaya, and the new SEAC radio station at Akola was taken over by the War Office in London, though there seemed to be very little change in the programming content. Around this time, the station was receiving some 8,000 letters a month from listeners around the world, and all were answered, usually with their rather plain, though these days highly prized, black text QSL card. The War Office in London ended its control of Radio SEAC Akola at the end of February 1949, at which time it would seem the station was closed for just a few weeks. However, at this stage, the BBC in London needed a temporary fill-in station due to the fact that they were in the process of constructing a huge new station at Tebrau on the Malay Peninsula, and they were transferring their operations from Jurong on Singapore Island to the new Malaya station. Thus it was that the BBC London took over the ex-SEAC station at Akola in Ceylon on April 1st, and the station began the broadcast of BBC programming beamed to Asia. At the end of the following year, 1950, the BBC transferred their programming relay from Akola to their new Far Eastern relay station at Tebrau in Malaysia, and they ended their temporary usage of the SEAC station in Sri Lanka.
Good evening, listeners. This is the national service of the Ceylon Broadcasting Corporation, broadcasting to listeners on 59.58 meters, 502 kilohertz, 326 meters, 920 kilohertz, and 93.3 megahertz. The time now is 10 seconds past 5 p.m.
During all of these events, the radio scene in Ceylon was also changing. At Radio Ceylon inaugurated a new commercial service under the program management of Clifford Dodd, who had recently come in from Australia under the auspices of the Colombo Plan. This new commercial service was inaugurated on September 30, 1950, shortly before the BBC left the scene. On the very next day, October 1, 1950, the Adventist Church began a program relay from the new Radio Ceylon. As the very first customer of this new commercial service on shortwave via the Akala radio station, thus began a long-time association with Radio Ceylon, the Sri Lanka Broadcasting Corporation, that developed ultimately into the formation of the International Broadcasting Unit AWR Asia, Adventist World Radio in Asia. Among the legendary announcers in the commercial service on shortwave from Colombo, whose names and voices were so well known throughout southern Asia and beyond, were, for example, Vernon Correa, Jimmy Barucha, Shirley Pereira, and Nihal Bharati. In fact, during the height of its success, it is stated that half of all shortwave radio receivers in India were tuned to the SLBC All Asia service. For several years, they operated a commercial office in Bombay in neighboring India, and a specially designed QSL card was also available from this Bombay office. At 7:18 on the morning of Thursday, January 5, 1967, Radio Ceylon, the Ceylon Broadcasting Corporation, transmigrated and officially became the Sri Lanka Broadcasting Corporation. On the technical side, the Voice of America constructed their own transmitter building adjacent to the SEAC installation, in which six transmitters were installed, two at 10 kilowatts, three at 35 kilowatts, and one at 100 kilowatts.
Is the Voice of America with its final morning sign-off from the transmitting station at Akala, Sri Lanka. VOA has been transmitting from this facility since 1953. Beginning tomorrow, VOA will expand its schedule from the new transmitting station at Iranavila, Sri Lanka. We salute all the Sri Lankan and American employees at the Akala station who, during the past 46 years, have helped VOA be heard.
Around the same time, another eight transmitters at 10 kilowatts, all Philips from Holland, were installed in the main SEAC building. Since that time, the Japanese installed two Kokusai shortwave transmitters at 300 kilowatts in a new adjoining building, and they replaced four of the ailing 10 kilowatt transmitters in the main SLBC transmitter hall. We should also mention that several other international radio broadcasting organizations have also utilized the relay services of SLBC Akala. For example, back in the 1940s, the live programming from All India Radio Delhi was relayed at times via the Akala shortwave station. Then, in the 1980s, the programming from Transworld Radio was carried over at least three different shortwave transmitters at Akala: a 10-kilowatt Philips, the 12.5-kilowatt standby transmitter, and a 35-kilowatt VOA transmitter. The programming of Family Radio and FIBA Radio were also heard from Akala, as were other well-known Christian programs. Back in the earlier years, Akala carried the broadcast of special sports programs from Radio Australia as an onward relay to the BBC London. Then in the 1980s, the Sri Lanka Broadcasting Corporation made a gracious offer to Radio Moscow to act as a relay station on their behalf, though this offer was never implemented. The venerable 100-kilowatt Marconi transmitter that was inaugurated under SEAC back in 1945 was still on the air, it is reported, even just 10 years ago. According to some authorities, the official call sign for the Akala shortwave station in recent time was 4SN. Regarding the closure of the Akala shortwave station, we quote a recent email message from Victor Gunatilika. He said, "This historic station, which began at Akala under the wartime Southeast Asia Command, Radio SEAC, is now on its last legs. Of the three VOA 35-kilowatt transmitters, only two are working, though the two NHK transmitters from Japan are both still in good condition. But spares are not available, and they are too expensive to repair and run. The old 10-kilowatt Philips transmitters are almost gone, and the old Marconi from the Radio SEAC days is rusty with cobwebs and gone forever. This old, historic, and venerable transmitter base at Akala on the island of Sri Lanka is silent forever, and a modern housing complex will take its place. Taking its place on the shortwave radio scene is the former shortwave relay station operated by Deutsche Welle at Trincomalee on the east coast of the island of Sri Lanka. All we can say is, Akala, you performed well. Thank you, and goodbye."
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
And that was our tribute to Akala. It was produced and presented by Jeff White. Now, just a quick program note from PCJ Radio International. Those listening in Latin America right now can catch our weekly radiogram Sundays at 0227 UTC, at 0227 UTC on 9,955 kilohertz. Yes, we put out a weekly radiogram and we like to get reception reports from it. We are creating a weekly show that will be a radiogram, and we'll announce that on a future edition of the program. Listeners to this show right now in Southeast Asia and East Asia, I just want to tell you about a time change that we're making for our Sunday transmissions. We were broadcasting from 13 to 14 hours UTC, but a number of you have been letting us know that the first 15 minutes of those transmissions in some areas are receiving some co-channel interference from China and India. So instead of changing frequency, because the frequency that we are using is very good, we're making a time change. So beginning June 30th, that's this Sunday, our new time will be from 13:30 to 14:30 UTC. From 13:30 to 14:30 UTC on a frequency of 11835 kilohertz. Now, you can send your reception reports in to let us know how it's coming in by going to pcjqsl@pcjmedia.com. That's pcjqsl@pcjmedia.com. That one-hour transmission consists of Focus Asia Pacific with our good friend Andy Sennett, and that is followed at 13:45 with the Happy Station Show. So do tune in. For more details, you can visit our website, www.pcjmedia.com. This is Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
Hi, this is Ian McFarland. If you're an SWL and feel nostalgic for the good old days of shortwave, you'll be interested in three sets of CDs that Colin Newell and I have produced. The first gives you 100 ident and interval signals from stations around the world. Then there's the foreign language recognition course that will help you identify the myriad languages that you can hear on shortwave. And the newest CD set, a look at the past 20 years in shortwave broadcasting with some of my broadcasting colleagues, and a look into the future. The proceeds from the sale of these CDs are in aid of a charity, a food bank for the less fortunate in my city of Duncan, British Columbia in Canada. Learn more about these CDs on the dxr.ca internet website. That's dxer.ca. Good listening, everyone.
The British DX Club is one of the world's leading DX clubs, with hundreds of members both in the UK and around the globe. BDXE produce a comprehensive monthly magazine called Communication, covering all aspects of the DXing hobby. The BDXE Audio Circle is also available and is a monthly program of DX catches and general chat about radio. For more information, please write to the British DX Club, 10 Hemdene Hill, Caversham, Reading, RG4, 7SB in the United Kingdom, or visit the website at www.bdxc.org.uk. That's www.bdxc.org.uk.
Hi, this is Bob Zanotti. Do you miss Swiss Radio International? If so, I invite you to visit my website, SwitzerlandInSound.com. Colorful and informative radio features about Switzerland, its destinations, interesting people, politics, culture, and even the two Bobs, SwitzerlandInSound.com, where English language radio from Switzerland lives on.
Now, let me play you a little sound, and let's see if you can guess what it is.
なるほど。はい。それは具体的に。これは、あの、いろんなね、玉すれとか紙切り持ってて、人がブワー来るんですよ。はい。本当に、うわ、よかった。だから、人がもう。緊急地震速報です。強い揺れに警戒してください。動かないぐらい。すごいんですよ。本当に。緊急地震速報です。強い揺れに警戒してください。番組の途中ですが、緊急地震速報です。
宮城県、青森県、岩手県、山形県、福島県、秋田県、茨城県、栃木県。
Well, that's the sound of Japan's earthquake and tsunami warning system. if you're watching a television show and a severe earthquake happens, they actually broadcast that message. Many countries have these, including the United States, which is not for earthquakes. It's for hurricanes and tornadoes and everything else. And it sounds like this.
The National Weather Service in Peachtree City has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for northern Clayton County in north central Georgia, southern DeKalb County in north central Georgia, south central Fulton County in north central Georgia.
That's the National Weather Service from the United States with their emergency broadcasting system and how it sounds, for those who are not familiar with it. If you go online, you can find many more recordings of it. Now, earlier this month, in the mid part of the United States, an area called Tornado Alley, there were a huge amount of deaths that occurred when a series of tornadoes devastated thousands upon thousands of people. Emergency services did kick in, and the United States has a very interesting system when it comes to it. To find out more, we're now joined by our good friend Dan Hensley, and we spoke to him about the emergency system in the United States. Dan, we've seen natural disasters happen around the world. They can either be earthquakes, they can be major volcanic eruptions, they can be hurricanes, and tornadoes are mostly connected to the United States. Now, for somebody who doesn't know about this area, because, you know, you see it on television, and when you look at it on television and you see the map and they're, you know, they're talking about the tornadoes that have hit the ground, it doesn't look like a big area, but this is a vast area, in fact, isn't it?
Oh, yes. It's from Texas all the way north to Missouri and even into the southwest corner of the state of Illinois, sometimes even to the northeast corner of the state of Illinois. And, you know, we've seen outbreaks over the last 24 hours now reach as far as way out east to, like, Pennsylvania.
So this is a weather area that is quite extraordinary because you have hot air from the Gulf of Mexico going north, and then you have cold air coming in from Canada. They sort of meet in the Midwest in the U.S., and then all of a sudden these tornadoes appear.
Oh, absolutely, especially in states like Oklahoma and Nebraska, like I said, Texas, Alabama, Indiana, Ohio, Iowa, Missouri. And it just really depends on how the weather system plays out. But, I mean, Tornado Alley is that expanse of the U.S. in the central Midwest United States, expanding 1,000 miles north from Texas and maybe a little more than that, and then 1,000 miles east and west from each other. So it's an expansive territory.
Now, what is the tornado season? Now, here in East Asia, we get hit with a lot of typhoons, and typhoon season is usually from the mid of May until the end of September. What about tornado season?
Well, tornado season here usually is, you can say, about the end of March through the end of September, really. I remember 1 year, about 4 years ago, we had a rare tornado outbreak up here as far north as Illinois, and it was like, I think, the day after Christmas. So it can happen anytime.
And is there any estimates about how many tornadoes happen every season? Because tornadoes are not like say, a hurricane or typhoon that can go on for days. Tornadoes can happen. They last sometimes 2 minutes. Sometimes they can last 30 minutes.
Well, you know, we've seen tornado outbreaks that go as far as 3-4 days at a time, sometimes longer, and sometimes shorter. It really varies. I mean, there is no real set estimate because every tornado season is different. You may have a tornado season where you see only a few. You may have a tornado season where you see 50 or more, or even in the hundreds. And that's not even in the hundreds is not even rare.
Now, most countries that will have these kind of natural disasters that are regular occurrences every year obviously have emergency systems set up. And I've noticed it doesn't matter how good the emergency system is or the communication system that's in place, sometimes the unexpected can happen. But let's talk about those who live in Tornado Alley, because tornadoes form really quickly, really, really quickly. What kind of warning systems are in place?
Well, we have our broadcast system, the National Emergency Communications System, and that's not even what they call it, but it's like our national warning system. And, you know, it's just a shrill siren that comes over your TV and your radio, and it'll tell you there's an emergency, and it'll usually say the National Weather Service has predicted or has activated the emergency communication system, and it'll tell you there's a tornado warning, or, you know, in the event of a hurricane in a coastal area, a coastal hurricane warning, and it'll tell you, you know, seek shelter and get off the streets and all that other basic safety stuff. We also have a HF net that happens between the Homeland Security umbrella of agencies and then the amateur radio operators and MARS in the events that, you know, things get really out of hand. And this, there's just no way around the fact that there's going to be loss of life and massive loss of property. And then there's your local storm spotter nets that are on your VHF and UHF repeater systems, where the National Weather Service will activate their storm spotters that are trained. And depending on how many teams need to be involved, there may just be one repeater system, or there may be several repeater systems with a liaison repeater where all of the different net controls report to, and then that repeater liaison operator will then notify the National Weather Service of all the reports they get.
And how much time is given? I mean, if I take, say, Japan or Taiwan for a moment, Japan has a tsunami warning system and an earthquake warning system. And if memory serves me correctly, for tsunamis, they can usually give between 7 to 15 minutes notice. For earthquake warnings, it's 10 to 12 seconds notice. What about for tornadoes?
Well, for tornadoes, depending on the area and depending on whether or not you have a meteorologist that sees a hook echo before a spotter sees it, and they can get the warning out that way, or depending on if a spotter calls it in via whatever mode of communication is there to use at the time, and depending on what mode of communication is the fastest, you know, it can take usually no more than a minute for them to receive a notification from one of us in the field. But then once it hits broadcast media, it can take up to 5 minutes from the time they receive the report, because they actually have to go and look at the radar, they have to confirm the report, and then they have to get the report out. So you're looking from the time they receive the report to the time it gets out to the public, anywhere between 3 to 5 minutes.
Now, let's talk about the communications, because we've seen during other disasters before, and it has happened where there's a communication breakdown because you have so many different departments involved. You have fire department, you have ambulance service, you have police service. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. Is there, for example, one central communication base to communicate with the different agencies involved that are, let's say, for saving lives or for other things, to prevent a communications breakdown?
I've never seen a free-for-all. I've never heard of it happening, although it's possible that in the absolute worst of natural disasters, you can have that happen where systems break down, and they have to call on the very last, you know, in line to help them communicate, in which case it would be the amateur operators. But in the event that they need everybody to work together, there is one central command. It's actually in Oklahoma, believe it or not. And so they will then compile all the information and work as a joint and a unifying command system to take and get all that information out to everybody as one piece of information, and then everybody takes that, and they have a system that they work under. So the medics are doing their medical thing. The hospitals are preparing for the medics to bring their injured and other folks in, and law enforcement is doing their job. And in the event that the National Guard would be needed in the state, they're doing their job. So everybody knows their place.
When the communication system does break down, do ham radio operators respond?
Oh, absolutely, but they do not ever, as a rule, self-deploy. They're called out through the Amateur Radio Emergency Service, which is an agency of the American Radio Relay League. they can be called out by their existing RACES leaders, which is the Radio Amateur Civil Emergency System, and they get called out by that. And so these people then, RACES and ARIES, a lot of them are one now, except in some places where they still function separately, but they still are the left and right hand for each other and work together in different respects. So they do come into play. And when they come in, they know what they're doing because they're given specific orders to do very specific things.
Many years ago, Dan, I remember, I think it was more than 20 years ago, visiting a Radio Shack in upstate New York in the United States. And they had these radios that they were selling, which were weather radios. Now, I don't even know if they're even still selling these anymore. But would you say that people that live in Tornado Alley, that a lot of people would have these radios at home?
You would hope they do, and the National Weather Service is constantly telling people, as well as, you know, the local sheriff's departments and the local emergency management agencies are telling these folks, look, get a weather radio and have your SAME tone programmed in, so that way you get the local tone for your area. And keep that thing active and plugged in. Keep it charged if it's running on battery power or whatever, because you never know when something will happen. I mean, not every storm is going to be predicted ahead of time. It happens all the time where storms just pop up, and they can become very strong and very violent very quickly and produce tornadoes. And before anybody knows what happened, it's all done and over with. It can happen just that quickly. So you need a weather radio or have a scanner or a piece of amateur radio equipment with your local weather service frequencies in it and your local sheriff's department, your local law enforcement, your local fire department, because, you know, amateur radio operators are not called up until the weather becomes severe and until they see an actual need for them. So you're not always going to have spotters on the ground with, you know, moment-to-moment radio access unless the National Weather Service sees a need for it. And, I mean, there are people that are not licensed amateurs that are on the ground that are trained spotters. They're out there. They're doing their thing. And sometimes they're in the right place at the right time, and sometimes they just don't hit pay dirt, so you never know.
Dan Hensley, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're now going to talk about antennas. One thing that we're finding out from our transmissions to Southeast Asia and East Asia, people create all kinds of antennas. And one of those transmissions we decided to invite on the program, our good friend Victor Gunatelica, to talk about how you can improve reception.
Exactly, Keith. And looking through the huge number of reports I've been getting, most of them are city dwellers there. And they have two main problems. They either use a little portable radio or even maybe a communications type, but they have a problem of antennas. To where do I put my antenna? Some people have problems with the city council. They wouldn't allow you to have an antenna outside, even if you can just string a piece of wire outside your window to a telegraph pole. And then the other main problem is electrical noise. Now, almost everybody is plagued with this problem now, electrical noise. And if you don't have an external antenna, if you're just depending on the telescopic whip, what happens is our signal or most signals that come in are not enough to override the noise level, so that sometimes you are battling with the noise 50-50, sometimes you are completely covered, and other times you just manage. So the main thing is, if you have a portable radio, you are living in a city apartment maybe, you need some form of external antenna. Now, I'm not going to tell you to buy a Yagi antenna or big, no, just something simple. Try at least throwing a piece of wire outside your window if you can, or even inside your room, maybe like a loop experiment. That's the only thing I can give you as a positive response. And there are some antennas, commercially made active antennas, small loops, and things that you can hang on your curtain pole. Now, things like that will definitely increase your signal level, but sadly, sometimes it also increases the noise level. We are living in city apartments and in houses with lots of electrical appliances, and we have what we call a noise halo, and we live within that. If you can throw an antenna away from your house, maybe bring a lead in underground or just at ground level, a coaxial cable or something, and connect onto your antenna, that might improve the situation. And connecting, most portables might have an external connecting point, a screw maybe, or jack or something. Very often it comes with a little package that you get with the radio, an external wire. Now, what I am trying to tell you is, please don't throw it out to the best direction you think is right.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, you
try it in different directions.
Just the other day, Victor, I was thinking about the very first antenna that I actually built for myself. The radio, this is going back to the late 70s. The radio was an old national radio. And the reception, this is when I was still living in Canada, the reception in the area where I lived was good, but I wanted to improve it. And somebody had told me something, and this was done during the Second World War in certain parts of Europe. Because many of our listeners may not know, but during the Second World War in Europe, countries that were occupied by the Nazis, they made radio listening illegal. So it was illegal to listen to the BBC and other stations that were broadcasting to Europe at the time. Now, what people did was they had to create, to make external antennas, but make them not seem like external antennas. Mm-hmm. And one idea that was given to me, and it truly works, is you build a clothesline, the kind of thing that you hang your laundry on. And you have a pulley at one side, a pulley at the other, so you can actually string your laundry along and move it along. And depending on what kind of clothesline you use, now you cannot use a rope-type clothesline because no, that's just not going to work. You have to use a wire-type clothesline. And it works well. And I built one myself that we even used at home to hang laundry on.
Yeah, and if the clothesline antenna you're using, the wire, has insulation, absolutely perfect. You don't have to strip the whole thing. Some people ask, have I got to strip the wire so that the bare copper or whatever has to be exposed? No, no, negative. Just throw it and put your laundry, your best shirt out, and it might even improve your reception.
Now, let's talk about one thing, Victor, that a lot of people would bring up. Now, this is something here in Taiwan that I have to do, and I'm sure that you have to do it in Sri Lanka because of we're now in a time of year where we get a lot of rain, a lot of thunder and lightning storms. So grounding, of course, is very important. Do all antennas have to be grounded? Because I know that some people are wondering, well, if I of course, have 150 meters of wire, I could understand, but let's say it's only 1 meter or 2 meters. Do all antennas have to be grounded?
Well, if it's a matched antenna, for instance, if you are using a long wire antenna, there's no need to ground it. But if you are going for a specialized antenna, if you are using a dipole, or if you are using a special antenna, a good design, a matched antenna, definitely you have to ground it because the grounding part is also an important part of the antenna design. But if you are talking about simple antennas, throwing a little piece of wire, not necessary. Some radios cannot be grounded at all, unfortunately, the little portables and all that. So it all depends on what type of antenna you're using.
Are there any materials that an antenna, of course, don't mention obvious ones like rope or string or wood, but are there any type of metals that should not be used for antennas because they will create more noise than there should be?
Well, yes, definitely. I would ask you not to use plain galvanized wire because it will give you more noise than signal. You know, it's all about conductivity. If you can afford copper wire, excellent. Aluminium wire, fine. But just steel wire, it's not worth the length of the wire that you'll have to throw in. So I would say, I mean, today you can easily get some copper wire, you know, electrical wire, insulated wire, lamp cord, just buy a few meters of it and try it. It's not worth going in, throwing even 100 meters of galvanized wire. It's cheap, but it won't do you anything very good.
And that was our good friend Victor Gunatelica telling us how you can improve your shortwave reception. And finally on the program, let's talk about reception and what we can expect with propagation. Dan Hensley is back, our propagation guru.
Here's propagation for the week from June 29th to July 5th, 2013. A 10.7 centimeter flux of 115 from June 29th to July 1st. From July 2nd to July 3rd, 110. July 4th and July 5th, 105. An A index of 8 on June 29th. July 30th through July 4th, we'll see an A index of 5, an A index of 10 on July 5th. The KP index starts out at 3 on June 29th, and then from June 30th to July 4th, the KP index will be 2. On July 5th, a KP index of 3. Sunspots 17, 72, 74, 75, and 76 are passing out of view. 1777, 78, and 79 are in view this week. None of these sunspots poses a threat for strong flares. Solar activity is low. The biggest thing on the sun today is not a sunspot, it's a coronal hole. The large dark gap in the sun's atmosphere is almost directly facing Earth, and winds from that should be reaching us here on Earth from June 29th to June 30th. The impact could spark geomagnetic storms around the poles. High latitude sky watchers should be alert for auroras at the end of the month. Back to you, Keith.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus for the month of June, the monthly version of the program. If you wish to contact us with your ideas or suggestions, our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. You can also use the same email address to receive our QSL card. So on behalf of everyone that helped put the program together, this is Keith Pallon wishing you well. We'll see you next month. Or you can also join us for the weekly edition of the program on the World Radio Network Sky Digital and through our many partner stations. Until next time, so long, take care. 73 and 88 for the ladies.